This is Conquering Columbus.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Conquering Columbus podcast. This is your co-host, Mike, here, and this is episode 372 of the show. On this episode, Josh and I got the chance to chat with Kelly Griesmer, president and CEO of the Women's Fund of Central Ohio. During the interview, we chat with Kelly about her career and passion for social justice, as well as what the Women's Fund of Central Ohio is doing to help support women here in town. Early on in the episode, we asked Kelly how she ended up getting involved with the Women's Fund. Here's what she had to say.
The reason I was so drawn to the Women's Fund when it opened this very small office in the Huntington Center by 15 women who put in their own money, you know, no nest egg, no big check from any corporation or any family foundation. They put in their own money and said, there's a funding gap for women and women's potential. We have to start to fill that. That's what Women's Funds do all across the country.
Later, we spoke about the types of folks that support the Women's Fund and how they balance the different requirements.
The great problem we have is we have a lot of different donors, and they have very different portfolios. So I can't ask a grassroots donor is very interested in something very different than a corporate donor, and it makes it challenging. But we are very, very fortunate we have both. We don't get a lot of federal or county money like some nonprofits. We are donor-based, but every range of donor in the profile.
Towards the end of the interview, we asked Kelly about some of the challenges faced at the Women's Fund. Here's what she said.
The biggest challenge for us, and this is not, I don't mean this as a boo-hoo, but we live in a world where we are a largely women-led, women-run organization raising money to fund other women-led organizations. So at the same time, I'm trying to be bold and trust-based for the people we fund. I'm not necessarily boldly and trust-based invested in myself. The biggest challenge for us is me realizing I'm still subject to bias in my organization, even having women in the name. There are unconscious and conscious biases that are applied to us.
We had a great time talking with Kelly, and we hope you enjoyed the interview just as much as we did. That's it for me. Let's get on with the show. Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Conquering Columbus podcast. This is your co-host, Mike, here. We've got Josh over there, and this is the show. Josh, how you doing?
Good, dude. How are you?
I'm good, man. Good. Actually, fun fact, now, officially, all of Conquering Columbus is headquartered in Columbus.
That is true. Our third partner has moved back from the depths of Detroit to beautiful Columbus, Ohio.
You know, I mean, I'm sure Detroit is nice and all, but I got to say, Columbus is a lot better. I've been there a few times. Much bigger fan of Columbus than Detroit. But if there's anybody here that's a big Detroit fan, please don't comment. I don't want to hear about it.
Oh, it's not Conquering Detroit, so I think we're going to be okay.
That's fair. That's fair. Well, there we go. We got our awkward intro out of the way. I guess it's a good time as any to introduce our guest. So
we actually can avoid that going forward, too. I tell you every time, nobody is requiring this awkward intro. You put it upon us every single time we get on here.
Yeah, but it's a tradition at this point.
It's awkward for our guest. She wants it to end.
Well,
we're all just waiting for it.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Well, here, introducing our guest. So joining us today is Kelly Griesmer, and Kelly serves as the president and CEO of the Women's Fund of Central Ohio, a public foundation with a mission to transform the lives of women and girls by mobilizing the collective power and passion of all people working together. She's a bridge builder with an unwavering commitment to gender equity, inclusivity, and women's and girls' leadership. And Kelly has a proven track record of creating social change for women, girls, and families here in Central Ohio. We're excited to be talking with her today about her career, as well as everything the Women's Fund of Central Ohio is doing to support women and girls here in Columbus, which actually is a bit more important to me these days than it used to be, having a daughter here soon. So welcome to Conquering Columbus, Kelly.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, we're excited to have you on the show. So one of the first places we like to start is just get a little background on yourself, your story, even as far back as like, hey, have you always lived in Columbus?
I have not always lived in Columbus. I grew up in Akron, Ohio, and went to IU, Indiana University, for undergrad. So ventured a little bit outside Ohio, but came back, went to law school here in Columbus, Ohio, and that's where my career began. And I was very, very interested in social justice at the time, but dating myself, I'm pre-internet, pre-Google. So being interested in social justice lawyering in 1993 when I was graduating was not an easy thing. Mm-hmm. You went to law school, you found a job at a law firm, and that's how you became successful. And so I did that and practiced law for 15 years. And then really, though, always had that warrior spirit, that mm-hmm. piece of me that said, you know, you're not only supposed to be a good advocate, you're supposed to be a good advocate for people that's voices aren't being heard. And having a lived experience as someone who identifies as a woman, that was always very important to me. But found a couple of different paths here to move from being a lawyer to being a social justice advocate. And so have been really happy, though, that entire journey has been here in Columbus, because I think one of the reasons my husband and I married not long after law school and moved back to Columbus. We spent a short time back up in the Akron, Cleveland area, but found Columbus to be the place that we thought we'd have the most opportunity. And that's certainly been true.
So there's a couple things I'm curious about, and I'm sure Josh will want to dig into the details around the experience in the law firm and things like that. But why law? That's the first one I'll start with.
So I was a journalism major first. And it's because I always say that I have this warrior spirit that makes me believe that I'm just was born innately believing that I was there to be a voice or advocate for others. Journalism was an interesting place where I wanted to start. I really loved to write, and I thought I'd be able to dig into social issues and explain it to the world. And then you realize coming out of college that journalists don't make very much money, and I had student loans. And this is also where my gender equity journey began, although I didn't know it at the time, because no one was really encouraging me to do much other than go work for a local newspaper somewhere. I had really good grades. I'd done very well. I was very ambitious. And I don't think I realized how little people were encouraging me to. I wanted to go work for Rolling Stone. And, you know, back then that was incomprehensible to people. So the next safest thing when you have that level of ambition is that people counsel you to go to law school. And it was great advice, and I'm very proud to be a lawyer, but it was also, it's a very hard way to live out. You indulge parts of your personality that, I mean, I was a trained fighter.
Right.
You know, my job was to go in and advocate, and lots of pieces of my personality that went to sleep for a minute. Why a lawyer? Because it was the safest way to pay off my loans. And where most of the advice that was be given to me, if you're a young woman in 1993 or 1990 to 1993, journalism is not a safe way to live. Mm-hmm. Go to law school.
And so did you go to law school right after undergrad?
I did.
And did you say where you did undergrad and law school earlier? Did I miss that?
IU, Indiana University for undergrad, and then Ohio State for law school.
Okay. So that brings us to Columbus. That makes sense. And then so what area of law did you focus on for those, you said 15 years?
Correct, 15 years. I was a clerk for the first 2 years, so just learning from a judge, and then went to a law firm. I worked at Jones Day, which was at the time and probably still very close to the third largest law firm in the world, and was a business litigator.
And so at what point in that journey do you reflect back on it, or do you remember it vividly that you said, hey, look, it's time to move on and do something else?
Not long after I made partner at the law firm, I was very, very proud to make partner. It's not something that I ever thought was going to happen when I went there. I believed I would learn a lot, but you just didn't see a lot of women partners, not just at Jones Day, anywhere. And I would argue that it's still not something you see a lot today. And so
how many partners in total in a firm of that size?
At the time, so I always tell the story. At the time, there were 600 partners when I made partner. So this was in 2002 that I made partner. And at the time, I was in the first class of 100 women partners. So we were 1/6 worldwide.
But that was the first
class of 100.
Women. Yeah.
Correct.
Okay. So,
and that's not unique. I always want to say it's not unique to Jones Day. In fact, their numbers were pretty good.
Right.
But yes, it
was higher than I thought you were going to say.
I remember celebrating that they had crossed the threshold of 100 women partners of the 600 that existed at the time. So it was a very big deal that I made partner, that some of my colleagues made partner. Mm-hmm. That said, to answer your question, it was around then that I realized, oh my gosh, I've gotten to this place. What does it mean for the rest of my life? I mean, I was only still in my mid-30s.
Right.
And I was realizing there was a lot more to navigate to be truly successful in that type of occupation. And I also knew that my soul was telling me I wasn't where I was supposed to be, that I had started a long time ago wanting to be a reporter for Rolling Stone. And all of a sudden I was fighting bankruptcy cases on Wall Street, but still fairly far afield from where my young self had envisioned me going.
And at this point is where Pelotonia comes into the picture, right?
Correct.
So I guess what I'm curious about is you go from, you know, that journalism that kind of, hey, I want to do something more. Where does the Pelotonia piece come from? And you were part of that founding team, right?
Correct. So where it comes from is that I am focused on people first. I think that's what drives me. It's just what's most important to me. And I have a very, very good friend, Tom Lennox, who at the time had survived cancer at around 40 years old, had gone through horrible treatment, meaning very difficult treatment, and had survived thanks to the James. And he was looking for a partner, someone who cared a lot. He has had great vision for the mission and values and recruiting and how to make it something that would be successful. But there's a lot of permits and there's a lot of fundraising and there's a lot of donations processing. And I was a details person and I passionately believed in what he wanted to accomplish for himself and his children, because he didn't and doesn't want his children to ever suffer the way that he did. And so we realized we had to tackle cancer research differently. And there was this vehicle that people in Columbus had landed on that we thought could work here, and they had hired him. And so then sort of that moment of me realizing I'm not doing what I was supposed to do, my soul isn't fed by what I'm doing the right way, and also realizing that there was a purpose-driven, people-driven movement that was an opportunity I was never going to get again to start something. Now, it's the biggest risk of my life. There's a lot of people who think we were crazy, and there's a lot of people who told us we would fail a lot because they just didn't think fundraising for cancer research was viable in that way.
Well, you guys showed them. As we all know, Pelotonia is highly successful today. I guess what I'm curious about is, what are you most proud of in that period working as CEO of at Pelotonia?
I'm proud that we gave power to people to use what's one of the most awful things that any person, family, friend can experience. And we gave them a vehicle to take that negative experience and make it very positive. It really is about the experience. People have to realize that they can be part of something so much bigger than themselves. And yes, it is about the money, because money pays for research. Mm-hmm. And when the average person thinks about whether they could fund cancer research, they think, no way. I'm infinitesimally small and I don't matter. And we gave them a vehicle where they could see how much they matter to that process, and that there are younger, creative researchers who are making breakthroughs every day because they're receiving dollars they couldn't get any other way than through that vehicle, and watching people support each other on those bikes, on that route, is something that will live with me forever. The power of watching those people, it's indescribable.
Yeah, absolutely it is. And we've talked to Doug Ullman over from Pelotonia in the past on the show. I mean, it's a huge impact on the community, not just the, obviously there's the monetary impact, but I think there's an impact on just on the community here in Columbus as well, where it's like, I don't know, I don't think anybody in Columbus, it's like the, what do you call it, the 7 degrees of Kevin Bacon, but it's like the 2 degrees of Pelotonia. Like, most people know, if you haven't participated in Pelotonia, you directly know somebody who has. So it's been a pretty big movement and really impressive. But at the same time, during that time frame, you were also on the board at the Women's Fund of Central Ohio, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of your first introduction to the Women's Fund, right? So can you talk about that and kind of how you became a board member, and eventually, right, we'll get to the point where, hey, what decided you made to leave Pelotonia for the Women's Fund?
Yeah. So it's interesting because I was on the Women's Fund board before I made the change to Pelotonia, and they have a lot of similarities in that both were created by people who saw a need to fill a gap, most specifically a gap in funding for innovation and ideas and things that aren't happening. And they took the bull by the horns and created the vehicle themselves. So the reason I was so drawn to the Women's Fund when it opened, this very small office in the Huntington Center by 15 women who put in their own money, you know, no nest egg, no big check from any corporation or any family foundation. They put in their own money and said, there's a funding gap for women and women's potential. We have to start to fill that. That's what Women's Funds do all across the country. I'd had that sense of that on the board. So when Tom came to me with the idea to be part of Pelotonia, those two experiences spoke to me. That's what made me feel like maybe I had something in my quiver that I might be able to use to help him, because I'd seen us raising from a grassroots level with this idea of innovative funding. But we obviously, the model at Pelotonia was had this special component, which was this major weekend experience that would, whereas the Women's Fund is much more of a, it's a public foundation, much like, so the one little job I had in between, which is sort of the bridge, is that I worked at the Columbus Foundation and for just a few years. But it's interesting because what they all have in common is they are foundations where you amass money from all different kinds of donors and then look for innovative ways to reinvest those funds. And so that's the through line, is I was had been on the Women's Fund board long enough to see the power of it. I was really able to work in the creation of it, which almost no one has the opportunity to do, by making sure that Pelotonia's experience got off on the right foot. And then going back to the Women's Fund, knowing that we have very similar communities, mm-hmm. but cancer's a very real, tangible way that people feel the need to fix things. Gender equity is much harder. Mm-hmm. You know, getting people to understand that gender equity is something we need to fund because it's good for all of us. It's not as easy as when people go, and thankfully so. I mean, right. No one wants to have to go through the experience people go through with cancer. But so they're similar, but very different in that way.
Yeah.
And so what year is it that you decided to join the team full time?
At Pelotonia?
Over at the Women's Fund.
Oh, at the Women's Fund. I went to the Women's Fund at December of 2018.
So at that point, what was going through your mind that made you want to make the jump?
Yeah, great question. I said this to my colleagues at the Columbus Foundation because I hadn't gotten to work there very long when the Women's Fund position opened. And that was disappointing to me because I did see the opportunity. You know, there I was working with the entire Columbus community on very broad ranging ideas, and they were exciting. But I knew when the job opened at the Women's Fund, first of all, that I had been on the board for a long time and knew the power of the work, and I knew the history of the organization. I knew the founders of the organization, and I also knew the future of the organization. So I felt like I had a really cool 360 perspective that a lot of other candidates wouldn't offer. I also knew that having watched people come into the Columbus Foundation and say, I wish we could fix poverty. You know, that so many good philanthropic people in our community want to fix poverty. And the answer, I think, the simplest answer is invest in women. It is an unbelievably under-resourced half of our population. Even those of us that have worked in jobs and had the privilege of education, our wealth in 2019 was 40 cents to the dollar for men. And then when you start to look at the intersections, it gets lower and lower. So a Black woman in 2019, single woman, owns 2 cents for every dollar that a man owns. And that was pre-pandemic. So we do that kind of research so that we can say, Columbus is absolutely going to show the rest of the world. What we need to focus on are these gaps mm-hmm. and how to fix them. My answer was, I'm really inspired by what I do at the Columbus Foundation. I've been really inspired by what I do at Pelotonia, but I need to go over here because I believe I can have a great impact on Columbus and where we live if I can inspire people to tackle this thing that no one else in the United States especially is tackling, and that's women's wealth.
And what did the team look like when you joined? And what were your ideas coming in to lead this? Kind of, were there areas you really thought like, hey, we need to double down here. This isn't working. Maybe we need to cut. Can you walk us through that kind of thought process?
That's really hard. And I will say that, unfortunately, my decisions were very quickly also impacted by the pandemic. So there was a very
small thing.
Yeah. And, you know, small organizations like ours, the Women's Fund has never had a team of much larger than about 8 people. Mm-hmm. And even then, that's probably including like interns. And so we have a fairly small team. We're only, at the time when I started, we were less than 20 years old. So we had a team of about 5 people, but there were people that had left during the CEO transition. You know, the good news is we're the kind of place where you get really bright, smart people. Mm-hmm. But if they don't have opportunity, they're going to get plucked. And they did, and they have been, right? So when I came in, I clearly came into a team in transition where people were rethinking, is this the place to be? What's our future? We've been without a CEO for a minute. What does that mean for me? And so I came into that. And also, we exist on fundraising, which most people don't think. They see fund, and they think there's some money tree that I'm picking in the back to pay people for jobs. No, I'm raising money from them and then using it for my operations. And they forget about that piece. So because you can't work at a place like the Women's Fund and not pay people a livable wage.
Right.
And they need insurance. I mean, a lot of, and this is the thing with nonprofits generally, they'll say, well, you just hire people, but you don't pay them very much and you don't have benefits because it's a nonprofit. I entirely disagree. Having sure. worked in the for-profit world, I also know that that's exactly how we create more good for the world, is if we also have equal benefits. And there's this interesting challenge. So the team was small. It remained small. It became even smaller during the pandemic because people were getting opportunities. People were getting frustrated, if I'm honest, by the way we had to operate in the pandemic. And so, but I knew we have to take fundraising seriously in a job like ours, which means you always need people who can fundraise. That's not what a lot of people want to do as a job. So, you know, you can't have a team of just programmatic people. You can't have a team of just fundraisers. You have to have an interesting mix. So I did get pretty strategic about how to hire for a mix of people who were mission focused and willing to also help raise the dollars that would move us forward.
Hey, everybody. Mike here. We're going to take a quick break to talk about one of our sponsors, One Columbus. And we are very excited to partner with One Columbus. They really, really share the same vision as us here at the Conquering Columbus podcast, which is really building up the Columbus region to be one of the most prosperous regions in the United States. And One Columbus serves as the business location resource for companies across Central Ohio and around the world as those companies grow, innovate, and compete within the global economy. And they help us lead a regional growth strategy that develops and attracts the world's most competitive companies, grows a highly adaptive workforce, and prepares our communities for the future, inspiring innovation across the board. Their mission really is just ensuring the Columbus region is a vibrant place to build businesses and careers. So again, we really appreciate all of their support. You want to learn more about them, go check out their website, columbusregion.com. That's columbusregion.com. Thanks so much for tuning in. We'll be right back into the episode. Yeah, and when you fundraise, are you focusing more on corporate sponsorship or is it individuals? Like, where do you go when you're looking for that?
Yeah, we're everything. Mm-hmm. And so I think we had the benefit for most of our history of having a very successful big tent event, which allows us to, it's called Keyholder. It's existed since almost the beginning. We bring in important speakers. So you do have a corporate donor audience and you do have a grassroots donor. I mean, I think actually I say this to people a lot. The great problem we have is we have a lot of different donors and they have very different portfolios. So I can't ask a grassroots donor is very interested in something very different than a corporate donor.
Right.
And it makes it challenging. But we are very, very fortunate. We have both. We don't get a lot of federal or county money like some nonprofits. We are donor-based, but every range of donor in the profile.
How has the strategy and approach evolved over the last 2 to 3 years?
Strategy or approach for fundraising?
Yeah. And execution, everything that you guys are doing as an organization.
I would say our focus is very person-oriented. People really want to be in the room. Our bread and butter, very similarly to my experiences at some of my other jobs, was we create an environment where people feel joyful, they feel safe, they feel seen. So our methods of fundraising have revolved around that over the years. Create a big room or a small room where people want to come and feel joy and learn and feel vulnerable and all these things. And that means people of all identities too. It shouldn't just be a room of all women because gendered equity actually is very beneficial to men as well. And people identify as many different identities. So during the pandemic, switch to virtual was very difficult because people weren't getting that emotional tie mm-hmm. over Zoom. And we didn't have a lot of letters that were pre-drafted that were, that's not how we fundraise. So we had to try to create those feelings of connection through much less personal ways. And I think we did a decent job of it, but certainly coming out of this, we've been happy to be able to host rooms full of people again.
Right.
It's made it a lot easier. But you also have to be really thoughtful, I think, about exactly that. What does our mission mean to people? Mm-hmm. What does it mean to take a donation and have people really understand what happened with it? And how do you storytell? And we really are trying to dig into the who's our donor and how do they really understand their power? Because again, I can't say we cured X today.
Right.
But I do think people are starting to sense the feeling of being part of a movement, that their investments are moving the needle, and that's where we have to stay.
Yeah, and so maybe let's flip to talk about what happens post-fundraising, right? Where is this money going to? How are you guys supporting your mission, and what does that look like? Are you operating events yourselves? Are you donating to other causes? Like, walk us through that.
Yeah, it's three main pillars: research, grant making, and advocacy. So research we only do about every 5 years and we're about to take on another project. And the reason research is one of our pillars is because it's quite clear that women and people who identify as women are invisible in data. Everything from how women have heart attacks to what women's wealth is. Most rooms we're in, it's the first time people have ever considered what a woman owns. A lot of people now think about what a woman may make in her paycheck, but that's mm-hmm. just one prong of what your wealth profile is.
Right.
You can make a whole lot of money, but if you spend it all on childcare, mm-hmm. that's not very affordable and not very quality, you're not very wealthy.
Yeah. And on the flip side, you can not make a lot of money, but if you own a lot of stuff that goes up in value, you're still in a good spot.
Exactly. And very few women own a lot of things that go up in value, right? So this is exactly it. So we try to do research because it's not that women can't build wealth. It's that people don't even understand that they don't or why and what it could mean to our economy if they did. So the research is really important. We commission the research. I don't have a team big enough to do it. I don't have researchers on my staff, but we go out, we have a manager, we manage the research, try to do quantitative and qualitative data analysis, and then share it for free with everyone. So if I spend six figures on research, I'm going to give it to the companies here. I'm going to give it to the small nonprofits. I'm going to give it to large nonprofits. It's a huge benefit, we believe, to the community to do that. Grant making is the one people understand the most. We've given out almost $5 million in grants over the years. They're not large grants, but they're grants focused on organizations run by and for women and a lot of women of color. We're often the first dollars in. We strive to be the one that takes, in society's view, a little more risk, because women are always, almost always considered a risk, and especially women of color. And a lot of time, women of color, there's a lot of data out that shows women get about 1.5% of philanthropic funding, all women from all foundations, Gates Foundation, Mackenzie Scott, all these things, still 1.5% of all the philanthropic funding in the world goes to things focused only on women and girls. Women of color, it's less than 1%. And most of those women aren't even paid for the work that they do in their communities. It doesn't make any sense. So we try to be the person who fills that gap, who shows the confidence, who builds their capacity so that they can be funded by people who have more money. Or, and if other people aren't funding them, we'll keep funding them.
Right.
And try to do it in a very trust-based way, meaning we trust you. We don't need 1,000 reports. We don't need to ask 1,000,000 questions. You seem to be moving forward. And then the last thing that we do is advocacy, somewhat like what I'm doing right now, which is to say, I need to be out there telling people there's research you're not considering. There's people you're not seeing. I need to be out there saying there's people running great organizations that aren't getting funding. So we consider everything advocacy. That said, with certain legislation that's out there, we will absolutely take a stand within the guidelines that nonprofits can do. But we also do a program called Gender by Us, where we go to companies and we work with companies to vulnerably, hopefully groups of all identities, not just women, saying, here's how your biases are. I have them. We all have them. I think about it every day, and I'm still probably make bias mistakes every single day. We have to be vulnerable about that and see it and help each other be accountable for it. And so we consider that advocacy. So the dollars go to those three pillars: research, but research is expensive, so it doesn't happen quite as often. Grant making happens every single year. And like I said, we're probably going to cross that $5 million threshold, which is we feel pretty good about. And then the advocacy efforts that we do.
What are the biggest challenges you see going forward with respect to the goals you have laid out?
You know, that's a great question. The biggest challenge for us, and this is not, I don't mean this as a boo-hoo, but we live in a world where we are a largely women-led, women-run organization, raising money to fund other women-led organizations. So at the same time, I'm trying to be bold and trust-based for the people we fund. I'm not necessarily boldly and trust-based invested in myself. The biggest challenge for us is me realizing I'm still subject to bias, and my organization, even having women in the name, there are unconscious and conscious biases that are applied to us. And then yet, so this really played out in the pandemic, because when we couldn't have an event, when people couldn't experience us in the same ways, they couldn't see social change. I just didn't have a Rolodex of people I could say, could you just send me a check? They're like, well, I send you that check for that event every year. So that's not happening.
Right.
But yet there was at no time more that our grantees needed us. So I'm very proud of the fact that we hustled and used every asset we had and every reserve we had to not let up our end of the bargain to the people we're funding, even though it became incredibly difficult. And I think that challenge still remains a little bit, is how to be brave in a space where I know I may still be experiencing bias and not propagate that bias anywhere else.
Right.
Like, and not just say, well, it's happening to me, so it's okay if it happens to you.
Yeah.
It's an ongoing challenge. It's not just a fundraising challenge. It is even an advocacy challenge, because if I say something in a room that's very transparent, I mean, I'm often labeled as edgy, and I would argue I'm transparent. But I think if I looked differently and identified differently, I might not be considered so edgy.
Yeah. I mean, but that's reality. Right? Like, that's the world we live in. And without having those conversations, right, we can't get past that. I think the thing that you see a lot is a resistance to the conversation, which is a huge, huge challenge, right? It's like, hey, listen, everybody put the weapons down here, have a serious, like, come to the open table, have an open conversation. I think a lot of people can get, again, right? You talk about biases, right? I think that there's a gut instinct from, I don't want to say a lot of men, but really it's a lot of men. It's like, hey, you have a bias, and it's like, well, I'm not an IST, right? It's the label.
Correct.
That all of a sudden it's like turns into offensive. Well, that's not what we're saying.
It's vulnerability.
Right?
It's vulnerable. And I tell a story quite often about myself and watching my son play basketball back in the day, and these two women were in my way. I couldn't see the game. I was my son's game, and I'm ducking around. And finally I turned to my husband and I said, what are those women doing? Why won't they sit down? And he goes, they're the coaches.
Uh-oh.
I mean, so, but there I am. I mean, I had been a longtime member of the Women's Fund board. I wasn't yet working for the organization, but my point is, it didn't occur to me in a thousand years that those women were coaching these young boys. What's the big deal, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm not trying to be trite there. I'm just trying to say, this is exactly what it is. We all do it. So I'm not blaming my male colleagues or friends or anyone, but we do have to be vigilant mm-hmm. and accountable to each other in saying, I do it. It stinks. Let's not do this.
Right.
There's a better way.
Yeah. And I think that makes a lot of sense. And I think that's a good place to head towards some of our last questions of the show, unless Josh, you got anything else?
Nope.
All righty. Well, first of our last questions is, do you have any advice for our listeners out there? And, you know, frankly, we do have a slightly larger male than female audience. I think it's like 60-40, but mostly people, folks in and around Columbus.
Yeah. My only advice is very similar to what I just said, which is this is truly about vulnerability. People see an organization like ours or some of the people who try to highlight these issues and they do. I get it. Like, you feel like you're being blamed. You feel like people don't want you to have opportunities. That's not it. You know, I really do believe that if people earnestly go into rooms and work hard to see their colleagues and break some of the biases that literally we learn as children that are still with us. So you didn't make any conscious decision early in your life, women or men. And quite honest, this happens. Privileged women, white women, we have a lot of the same problem because there are still barriers we have never experienced. And so you make a decision very early on that that barrier just doesn't exist. And then it's very hard to admit it does exist. It just doesn't exist for me. And so really, that's all we're saying. And so the vulnerability of being able to say, and it's hard. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really hard. And I have more days than not had a moment where I'm like, you totally missed that point until today. I'm just turned 55 and I am mortified by how long that means that I held on to some of these beliefs. So if we can all walk into these rooms and when we do our trainings, you know, one of the things I do encourage people is to think about things like things where you can make incremental steps. Like if you're reviewing somebody for a job, you have certain words you will use for your female colleagues and your male colleagues. Mm-hmm. And just like I said, you know, someone who has aspirations versus being edgy. Mm-hmm. You know, if you are sensitive to that, all of us will realize ourselves doing it. And it comes up in a lot of situations. So my advice is be vulnerable, be willing to be part of the solution and be accountable. And I think this is what's particularly good about Columbus is you go in a lot of rooms where there are trust mm-hmm. and you can say things that I think in other places I've lived, I would not be as successful at saying some of the things that I say. So I think we do have a climate for that.
Love it. And Kelly, it's been great talking to you so far. Our last question of the show is centered around the theme here on Conquering Columbus, which is live uncomfortable. So without telling you too much about why we chose that phrase, what do you think of when you hear it? How does it apply to your life and career?
Well, it's just that. A comfortable decision today would be me still sitting at my desk at my law firm where I had a lot of colleagues that I really loved and people who'd been good to me, and I made a very nice salary. Mm-hmm. But I had to make a very hard decision at a pretty pivotal time in my life about whether that was what was truly going to make me the most worthwhile person I can be with the time I have on this planet. And it was not going to be the best way for me to do that. And that hurt some people's feelings. And I'm sorry. And I've made that at every job I've ever been in. You have to decide. So I've never loved a job more than I loved Pelotonia. But there was a point where I believed I was done with the part I was supposed to do. And it, you know, to this day, I can get a little bit emotional thinking about it. Like, you know, I miss it. Mm-hmm. But I uncomfortable is knowing that I'm still moving in a direction where I'm still having the most impact I believe I can have with the talents I was given. And also being willing to admit, whether I like it or not, that I'm wrong as many times as I'm right. And I just have to keep trying, you know, and that's a pretty uncomfortable feeling if you own it.
Fantastic. Well, Kelly, again, thanks so much for joining us. It's been a lot of fun. Conquerors, thanks so much for tuning in. By the way, if you want to support the Women's Fund of Central Ohio, you can go to
www.womensfundcentralohio.org.
There you go. www.womensfundcentralohio.org.
Yep.
Thanks so much for tuning in. If you want to hear more interviews just like this one, go ahead and hit that subscribe button on whatever podcast app you are listening on. Make sure you never miss an episode from us. We appreciate all your support. We'll talk to you next week.